Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's June 28th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Welcome to the broadcast. I'm going to be doing this on my own, and hopefully you'll be listening as well. Got some very, very interesting stories today. One is the liberal idea has become obsolete. That's what Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, is saying in an exclusive interview that was written in the Financial Times. So we're going to cover that, and then we're going to cover a lot of other international news and domestic news as well, and with commensurate analysis. One thing is for sure, now resurrecting our old standard lineup of people that attended the broadcast. So many of them were taken off or departed for their own reasons, and we were filled, literally filled for 2 hours every single day with candidates running for one political office or another. So that's going to be changing. It may take a couple of weeks to put it all together, but you and I will be here together. So let's read about Vladimir Putin's exclusive interview in the Financial Times, which is entitled "The Liberal Idea Has Become Obsolete." Well, Vladimir Putin has trumpeted the growth of national populist movements in Europe and the United States, crowing that liberalism was spent as an ideological force. Speaking in the Kremlin on the eve of the G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, Russia's president said that, quote, the liberal idea, end quote, had, quote, outlived its purpose, end quote, as the public turned against immigration, open borders, and multiculturalism. Mr. Putin's dismissal of liberalism, the dominant Western ideology since the end of the Second World War, chimes with anti-establishment leaders from U.S. President Donald Trump to Hungary's Viktor Orban, Matteo Salvini in Italy, and the Brexit insurgency in the United Kingdom. Liberals cannot simply dictate anything to anyone, just like they have been attempting to do over the recent decades, he said. Mr. Putin branded Chancellor Angela Merkel's decision to admit more than 1 million refugees to Germany, mainly from war-ravaged Syria, as a cardinal mistake, quote unquote. But he praised Mr. Trump for trying to stop the flow of migrants and drugs from Mexico. This liberal idea presupposes that nothing needs to be done, that migrants can kill, plunder, and rape with impunity because their rights as immigrants have to be protected. He added, every crime must have its punishment. The liberal idea has become obsolete. It has come into conflict with the interests of the overwhelming majority of the population. As the de facto ruler of Russia for almost two decades, Mr. Putin, who's 66, has been regularly accused of covertly supporting populist movements in other countries through financial aid and social media, notably in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, the Brexit referendum, and the recent European Parliament elections. Mr. Putin emphatically denied this, brushing aside the conclusion by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller that Russia had systematically interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election as, quote, mythical interference, end quote. Now, turning to the U.S.-China trade war and geopolitical tensions in the Gulf between the United States and Iran, Mr. Putin said the situation had become, quote, explosive, end quote. The problem, he said, stemmed from U.S. unilateralism and the lack of rules underpinning world order. He expressed concern about the threat of a renewed U.S.-Russia nuclear arms race. The Cold War was a bad thing, but there were at least some rules that all participants in international communication more or less adhered to or tried to follow. He said there were tentative signs of a thaw in Anglo-Russian relations before his meeting in Osaka and with Theresa May, her farewell summit as UK premier. I think Russia and the UK are both interested in fully restoring our relations, end quote. Now, relations between London and Moscow have been frozen since the attempted assassination of former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, England. The UK government blames Moscow for the nerve gas agent attack, but Mr. Putin said there was no evidence to support this. Mr. Skripal had served a sentence in Russia before being released in a spy swap with the UK, he noted. Mr. Putin made clear, however, that he had zero tolerance for spies who betrayed their country. Quote, treason is the gravest crime possible and traitors must be punished. I'm not saying that the Salisbury incident is the way to do it, but traitors must be punished. In recent years, Mr. Putin has become emboldened, presiding over the annexation of Crimea, a pro-Russia revolt in eastern Ukraine, and a military intervention in Syria. Now, Mr. Putin said that the Syrian operation had given Russia's armed forces invaluable fighting experience. He did not mention that the seven-year war has resulted in more than 5 million refugees and 500,000 dead. Mr. Putin said liberal governments had not acted to reassure citizens, arguing that they had instead pursued a mindless multiculturalism embracing, among other things, sexual diversity. I'm not trying to insult anyone because we have been condemned for our alleged homophobia, but we have no problem with LGBT persons, he says. Now, go to the next page because this continues on. So just before midnight, Vladimir Putin perks up at the mention of the word risk. It encapsulates the man and his 20 years in power. Laterally, Russia has embarked on a growing number of foreign policy gambles, from the military intervention in Syria, the annexation of Crimea, and the attempted meddling in the U.S. presidential election. Is his appetite for risk increasing with each passing year? Quote, it did not increase or decrease. Risk must always be well justified, he replies. But this is not the case when one can use the popular Russian phrase, quote, he who doesn't take risks never drinks champagne. His response is classic, Putin elusive and teasing, but on one issue he is certain he made the right choice, Syria. I believe that it has been a good and positive return. We have accomplished even more than I had expected. Aside from the killing of several thousands of Islamist militants and the shoring up of Bashar al-Assad's regime, he cites the reemergence of Russia as a power in the Middle East, uniquely able to talk to all parties from Israel to Saudi Arabia and Iran. Besides, I would like to openly speak of the mobilization of the Russian armed forces, he adds. Our armed forces have received such practical experience that they could not have obtained during any peacetime exercises. This matter of fact, some would say cynical, summation of an eight-year civil war that has led to the deaths of 500,000 people and caused 5.6 million to become refugees and millions more to be internally displaced, highlights the self-assurance of Mr. Putin. Here's a man who believes Russia is back at the top table and that history is on his side. Ever since the 2014 Crimea annexation, Mr. Putin has faced a concerted attempt to isolate him internationally, but on the eve of the G20 meeting in Osaka, Japan, and at a time when the U.S. role in the world has never seemed more uncertain, the Russian leader is still very much at center stage. During a 90-minute interview with the Kremlin's cabinet office, with statues of four of Imperial Russia's most revered rulers looking on from each corner, the former KGB officer turned statesman took on all subjects. He ranged from the breakdown of the international rules-based order, the rise of China, and the end of liberal ideology to the prospect of improved relations with the United Kingdom. Ahead of the G20, Mr. Putin highlights multiple risks to global stability. He singles out American unilateralism, starting with a tariff war against China and the threat of conflict in the Gulf. To put it bluntly, the situation has definitely become more dramatic and explosive, he says. The Russian leader detects a shift in the political balance of power from traditional Western liberalism to national populism, fueled by public resentment about immigration, multiculturalism, and secular values at the expense of religion. Quote, "Have we forgotten that all of us live in a world based on biblical values?" asks Mr. Putin, dismissing Karl Marx's dictum that religion is the opium of the masses. Similarly, in the Russian president's view, liberal ideology has, quote, outlived its purpose, end quote. Fragmentation characterizes the world of 2019. In response, Mr. Putin casts himself as a cheerleader of globalization alongside his increasingly close ally, President Xi Jinping of China. It is an improbable role for Russia and China, but one vacated by the United States under President Donald Trump, who has made, quote, America first, end quote, his mantra. Mr. Trump's trade conflict with China, alongside U.S.-led sanctions against Russia, have brought Beijing and Moscow closer together. Once wary neighbors, the two Eurasian powers have formed a strategic partnership based on energy investment, trade, and defense cooperation. Mr. Putin has met Mr. Xi 28 times since the latter took office in 2012. Is Russia, which has few friends left in the West, putting too many eggs in the Chinese basket? We have sufficient eggs, but there are not too many baskets to put those eggs in, he replies. We always assess the risks. Russia and China are not directing their policy against anyone. Later, he praises China for, quote, showing loyalty and flexibility to both its partners and opponents, an endorsement not extended to the United States. Now, some believe conflict is inevitable between the United States and China. They point to the parallel between a dominant Sparta and a rising Athens, the so-called Thucydides trap. Well, the Russian leader is circumspect. It is hard to say whether the United States would have enough patience not to make any rash decisions, but to respect its partners, even if there are disagreements. Mr. Putin has plenty of harsh words about America, but he is studiously polite about Mr. Trump, referring to him as Donald several times in the interview. Mr. Trump is not a career politician. I do not accept many of his methods when it comes to addressing problems, but do you know what I think? I think that he is a talented person. He knows very well what his voters expect from him. Mr. Putin wearily dismisses charges of orchestrated interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign. He insists Mr. Trump won in his own right by tapping the anti-establishment mood and the backlash against globalization. Quote, Russia has been accused, and strange as it may seem, it is still being accused of alleged interference in the U.S. election. What happened in reality? Mr. Trump looked into his opponent's attitude to him and saw changes in American society, he says. Mr. Trump has reciprocated by not directing criticism, Mr. Putin. The two leaders are scheduled to meet at the G20 in Osaka. The question is whether they can find any common ground, notably on arms control, where bilateral Cold War treaties that have underpinned the nuclear stability are being torn up. The United States accusing Russia of breaching the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty has notified Moscow it will withdraw by August 2nd in the absence of compliance. Russia denies it is in breach and accuses the U.S. of counter breaches, though missile deployment through missile deployment in Europe at the same time, a second treaty called New START, limiting the number of warheads, is nearing expiration in 2021. Now, Mr. Putin tells the Financial Times that Mr. Trump Mr. Trump intimated in a recent conversation that the U.S. was interested in extending New START, but no initiative has been forthcoming. Quote, so if this treaty ceases to exist, then there would be no instrument in the world to curtail the arms race, and this is bad, he says. Of the many gambles Mr. Putin is accused of taking, the attempted assassination of former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, England, in 2018 ranks high. Even 15 months on from the nerve agent attack, which London blames on Moscow, Mr. Putin bristles and says it is time to move on. Listen, all this fuss about spies and counter-spies, it is not worth serious interstate relations. This spy story, as we say, it is not worth 5 kopecks, which is the local currency, not like pennies. While the nerve agent attack did not kill Mr. Skripal nor his daughter, a member of the public died after coming into contact with a perfume bottle containing the nerve agent Novichok, which British officials say was manufactured in Russia. Now, the list of accusations and allegations against one another could go on and on. We need to just leave it alone and let security agencies deal with it, says the Russian leader. The same disdain in the face of international criticism surfaces in relation to Russia's backing for President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, who has installed an effective dictatorship. Mr. Putin denies that Russia is directly involved in propping up Mr. Maduro, arguing this is one more Russophobic conspiracy theory propagated by the West. The only presence of Russians are military contractors servicing defense assets, he says, adding that more could be sent. Mr. Putin immediately raises the toppling of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi by Western powers and the ensuing civil wars. Quote, so why should we do the same in Venezuela? Do we want to revert to gunboat diplomacy? What do we need it for? Is it necessary to humiliate Latin American nations so much in the modern world and impose forms of government or leaders from the outside? Well, the Russian leader insists this is a matter for Venezuelans to resolve for themselves, as far as Juan Guaido, the opposition leader recognized by the United States and other Western governments as the legitimate president. Mr. Putin says, quote, he may be just wonderful and his plans are good, but is it enough that he entered a square and proclaimed himself president, end quote. A popular uprising in Russia, encouraged by the West, is the stuff of nightmares for Mr. Putin. Having witnessed firsthand the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the fall of the Soviet Union, he has long harbored suspicions of Western conspiracies to undermine his regime. Now, the color revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine, as well as the U.S.-led interventions in Iraq and Libya, have further convinced him of malign intentions. For now, Mr. Putin looks politically formidable, but his regime's weakness lies in the economy, with stubbornly low growth and years of failing and falling real incomes. But the most important task we need to achieve is to change the structure of the economy and secure a substantial growth of labor productivity through modern technologies. Such a goal has long eluded an economy heavily dependent on oil and gas. Russian citizens are feeling the pinch through higher taxes and an unpopular increase in the pension age, which triggered a fall in Mr. Putin's trust rating to a 13-year low this spring. But rather than increasing spending, Mr. Putin is building a war chest. International reserves stand at about $500 billion, according to the Russian Central Bank. We need to create a safety net that would let us feel confident. Do not think that this money is just sitting on the shelf. No, it creates certain guarantees for Russia's economic stability in the midterm. This is an expensive insurance policy, but it comes amid the threat of further U.S. sanctions against Russia, which since 2014 has found itself increasingly cut off from Western capital markets. Just this week, the Foreign Affairs Committee in the United States House of Representatives approved a draft law that would sanction entities involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline being built between Russia and Germany, a move that would be a blow against critical energy exports. Now, the historic lesson. Believing himself surrounded by real and potential enemies, Mr. Putin has routinely chosen strength and aggression over compromise and restraint. His proudest accomplishment, he admits, is the restoration of the power of the Russian state after the chaotic collapse of the Soviet Union, an event he describes as, quote, one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century, end quote. Mr. Putin has no yearning for the communism of the past, where he says life was difficult, end quote. Now, the tragedy, he says, was the dispersal of ethnic Russians across the newly independent successor states of the USSR. 25 million Russians found themselves living outside the Russian Federation. Listen, is this not a tragedy? A huge one. And family relations, jobs, travel, this was nothing but a disaster. Throughout the two decades of his leadership, Mr. Putin has expended blood and treasure in efforts to rectify what he sees is a historical wrong. His favorite leader, he declares, is Peter the Great, a towering bronze statue of the visionary Tsar looms over his ceremonial desk in the cabinet room. Now, Peter the Great created the Russian Empire around the turn of the 18th century with a series of foreign wars that conquered land from Finland and the Baltic states in the north to the Black Sea in the south. This is the sphere of influence that Mr. Putin believes Moscow must defend at all costs and hence his visceral opposition to NATO's expansion eastward up to Russia's borders. Peter the Great, Mr. Putin says, he will live as long as his cause is alive. And Mr. Putin cannot yet claim to be a grand domestic reformer on the scale of his hero, nor has he shown any sign of developing a clear succession strategy. The Constitution requires him to stand down as president in 2024. The 66-year-old says he has contemplated his successor since 2000, but if indeed he has, it is the most closely guarded secret in Russia and a matter of some sensitivity for the president himself. As the clock ticks towards 1 a.m., Mr. Putin cannot resist one final jab, this time at the efforts of Britain's ruling Conservative Party to choose a new leader to succeed Theresa May. Either Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt will then become prime minister without a general election. It is different from what you have in Great Britain. We are a democratic country, he says. The choice is always made by the Russian people, end quote. In fact, Mr. Putin inherited the presidency on the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve of 1999 when Boris Yeltsin stepped down from office prematurely and endorsed him for his successor. When reminded of this, Mr. Putin shrugs, so what? Well, fascinating guy, that's to say the least. Well, let's move on to something else. First, let's find out what's going on in the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. the Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. Well, if you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, their number is different now. It's 347-415-4326. That's the office number, the cell number, the text number, the voicemail number, 347-415-4326. Let's find out what's going on around the world. I guess the most important thing right now is the G20 Osaka meeting of the G20. Now, migration, trade, Iran, and the climate are hot-button issues on the G20 agenda. Leaders from the group of 20 nations, that's why they call it G20, will meet in Osaka, Japan, starting today for a two-day summit. Now, leaders of the group of 20 nations gathering in Osaka will find the talks agenda dominated by the words and actions of U.S. President Donald Trump. High on the agenda will be the ongoing U.S.-China trade war, a potential shooting war with Iran, and migration from Latin America, one of the issues that propelled Trump into office. While Iran is not a G20 member, it will very much be there in spirit as the threat of war with the United States looms over a series of incidents in the Gulf and escalating rhetoric as Iran's nuclear ambitions are become the focus of the ire of the United States. Since President Trump took office, U.S.-Iran relations have cooled just as the rhetoric has grown more heated, with the U.S. pulling back from the brink of armed conflict in recent days, and the United States does not want a full-blown war with Iran, although it still is seeking to build up international defenses in the region just in case of a conflict, President Donald Trump's special envoy to the country said that on Thursday. Well, Iran is poised to surpass a key uranium stockpile threshold, threatening an accord it reached back in 2015 with world powers aimed at curbing its nuclear activity. Tehran made no immediate announcement on Thursday that it had done so, perhaps waiting to hear what Europe can offer at a meeting Friday to keep the deal alive. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron is trying to dial back tensions, saying he hopes to convince Trump to open talks with Iran and avoid a war that would engulf the Middle East. The two men are to meet at the summit on Friday. There is no brief war, Macron warned. We know when it's starting, but not when it's finishing. Now, U.S. Special Representatives for Iran, Brian Hook, met with two European diplomats on Thursday in Paris, and he told the Associated Press that he wants to get tougher on Iran instead of clinging to the nuclear deal that the U.S. pulled out of last year. We're not looking for any conflict in the region, he said in an interview, but if the United States is attacked, we will respond with military force. Britain, France, and Germany are finalizing a complicated barter-type system known as INSTEX, I-N-S-T-E-X, to maintain trade with Iran and avoid U.S. sanctions as part of efforts to keep the nuclear deal afloat. As well as the Gulf tension, tensions, oil markets are on edge about a looming deadline for OPEC to decide whether to extend production cuts, and that could be the focus of Osaka meetings between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Washington and Beijing are at loggerheads over tech and tariffs. So President Donald Trump and Xi Jinping of China will meet on Saturday, with each hoping to come out on top in a trade and technology contest that amounts to a trade war. The Americans want to safeguard their technological riches, restore balance to the top trading relationship, and force a sharp-elbowed rival to play by the rules and keep its word. The Chinese want the Trump administration to drop its tariffs so they can regain freer access to the world's largest consumer market while pursuing their goal of becoming a global technology superpower. Trump officials want China to end what they call its abusive practices, including forced technology handovers, and the use of regulations to hobble American companies operating in China. Now, China's reluctance to reform has cost it a key ally in the United States, American businesses, U.S. companies, which long backed China-friendly U.S. policy trade policies, but now are largely supportive of Trump's combative stance, if not the tariffs he's using as leverage. Now, Trump has suggested that he might be willing to use the fate of the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei as a bargaining chip in trade talks. The U.S. Commerce Department last month put Huawei on a blacklist, which effectively bars it from buying the U.S. technology it needs. I can imagine Huawei being included in some form of a trade deal, Trump said in May. He offered no details, but he said any arrangement would look very good for us. I can tell you that. Well, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, they call it AMLO, they call him AMLO, A-M-L-O, said on Thursday a letter he is sending to other leaders from the group of 20 nations would have challenges over migration as its principal focus. López Obrador is not attending the summit, but said he would send a letter to the other leaders. Migration would be at the heart of that message, he told his regular morning news conference on Thursday. The Mexican delegation to Osaka is due to be led by the country's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard. Now, blowing hot and cold air on the global warming issue. The latest draft of the G20 language on climate change, seen by Reuters, revives support for the 2015 Paris Agreement, calling it, quote, irreversible, end quote. An earlier draft had avoided that commitment at the insistence of the United States, two sources advised Reuters. Now, President Emmanuel Macron said France would not accept a G20 communication that does not, or communique that does not mention the Paris Accord. Trump, who has called global warming a hoax, pulled the United States out of the pact back in 2017. So, my God, there's so much that's going on in the world, huh? Who would have imagined? But there's definitely a ton of stuff going on. This is very interesting because we talk about global warming, and we find that France is frying as thermometers hit a record high temperatures. You're not going to believe this. France on Friday recorded its hottest temperature ever, a 45.1 degrees Celsius. That amounts to 111 degrees Fahrenheit, as Europe sweltered in an early summer heat wave already blamed for several deaths. Now, several people have died around the continent in incidents that authorities are linking to the exceptional weather. A major wildfire raged on Friday in Spain, sparked when a pile of chicken dung spontaneously combusted in the heat. Now, several countries have reported record temperatures this week, and France hit its all-time record high of 45.1 degrees Celsius, which, like I said before, is 111 degrees Fahrenheit in the small southern town of Villeville, according to French media. So the French National Weather Service activated its highest level heat danger alert for the first time, putting four regions around Marseille and Montpellier in the south of the country under special watch on Friday. Well, those schools that stayed open worked to keep kids cool. Teachers at the Victor Hugo Primary School in Colombes, near Paris, abandoned suffocating classrooms and are keeping children outside all day, spraying them with water and organizing quiet activities in the shade. I make them go to the playground with books in the shade. They must stay seated, said teacher Valerie Prévost. We tell them to dampen their caps, to drink regularly. About 4,000 schools closed because they couldn't ensure safe conditions, and local authorities canceled many end-of-school-year carnivals. Now, some criticized the government for going overboard, but Prime Minister Edouard Philippe defended the efforts. After 15,000 people died in a heat wave back in 2003 that woke France up to the risks. This heat wave is exceptional by its intensity and its earliness, he told reporters. measures have been taken for the most vulnerable people, he said. But given the intensity of the heat wave, it's the entire population who must be careful today, both for themselves and for loved ones and neighbors. Now, Italy put 16 cities under alert for high temperatures, and civil security services distributed water to tourists visiting famed sites around Rome under a scorching sun. Heat was blamed for the deaths of two people in Spain. Private news agency Europa Press reported on Friday an 80-year-old man collapsed and died in the street of Valladolid in northwest Spain. The agency said, and a 17-year-old boy died in the southern city of Cordoba after diving into a swimming pool and losing consciousness. Four people have drowned so far in France this week, and a 12-year-old girl drowned in a river near Manchester, England. France's health minister and British police warn people to swim only in authorized areas. Now, France has also been seen an uptick in so-called street pooling or illegally opening fire hydrants. A six-year-old child is in life-threatening condition after being hit by water shooting from a cracked open fire hydrant in the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis, a broadcaster France Info reported. And more than 600 firefighters and six water-dropping aircraft were battling the worst fire in two decades in the Catalonia region on Friday, as Spain is forecast to endure the peak of its heat wave, with temperatures expected to exceed 40 degrees Celsius. That's 104 degrees Fahrenheit. In Berlin, a police unit turned water cannons, usually used against rioters, on city trees to cool them down. My God, well, this doesn't seem like normal, that's for sure. So very, very frightening set of circumstances. They're just totally unexpected. Now, this is very interesting as well. Tunisia is moving to restore tourists after suicide attacks. Tunisian officials have sought to reassure tourists after twin suicide bombings targeting security forces struck the country's capital on Thursday, killing a patrol officer and injuring at least eight people. Prime Minister Youssef Chahed described the bombings as a cowardly terrorist operation to destabilize Tunisians, the economy, and democratic transition, noting that they happened as the tourist season was in full swing. In an interview with the Associated Press, his tourism minister, René Trabelsi, said he did not think the first attack was tied to the French embassy nearby, but had targeted Tunisian police. Islamic Jihad had claimed this assault. This attack against national security agents has nothing to do with tourists, said Trabelsi. A critical sector to Tunisia's economy, tourism amounted to some 14% of the country's gross domestic product and employed almost 500,000 people from a population of 11 million people back in 2014. But those figures plummeted following successive terrorist attacks in 2015, which threatened the country's relative political stability in the region. So the terror threat led to travel agencies pulling out and foreign governments issuing warnings for citizens planning to go to Tunisia. Since then, tourism has particularly bounced back, or partially bounced back, as government increased security around popular destinations. The tourism industry said he had, quote, a message to tourists, have a good holiday and come to Tunisia. Tunisia is a country that fights these terrorists. Thursday's bombings came as the country's 92-year-old president, Beji Caid Essebsi, who had been released from a brief hospitalization less than a week ago, was rushed again to the hospital after being struck with a serious illness, quote unquote. Prime Minister Shahed said he had paid a visit to the ailing president in a message posted on Facebook. I would like to reassure Tunisians that the president is receiving the necessary care, he said, warning against the dissemination of false and confusing information. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for Thursday's attacks through its AMAQ, A-M-A-Q, propaganda agency. It was unclear whether it was an opportunistic attack or claim. The Islamic State group was behind Tunisia's deadliest extremist attack, which struck at the heart of Tunisia's tourism sector back in 2015. One at the Bardo Museum in Tunis killed 22 people, and another 3 months later killed 38 people in the coastal city of Sousse. So, my God, you know, it's amazing. Everyone's at each other's throats. One second. This is really important because it goes back to what's happening here in the United States. Evidently, Biden was placed in the hot seat of a tense U.S. Democratic debate. Democratic divisions over race, age, and ideology surged into public view on Thursday night's presidential debate, a primetime clash punctuated by a heated exchange between former Vice President Joe Biden and California Senator Kamala Harris. It was one of several moments that left a 76-year-old Mr. Biden, who entered the night as his party's fragile front runner, on the defensive as he worked to convince voters around America that he's still in touch with the Democratic Party of 2020 and best positions to deny President Donald Trump a second term. Quote, "I do not believe you are a racist," Harris said to Biden, though she described his record of working with Democratic segregationist senators on non-race issues as, quote, "hurtful," end quote. Biden called Harris's criticism, quote, "a complete mischaracterization of my record," end quote. He declared, quote, "I ran because of civil rights," and later accused the Trump administration of embracing racism. The debate marked an abrupt turning point in a Democratic primary in which candidates have largely tiptoed around each other, focusing instead on their shared desire to beat Trump. But the debate revealed just how deep the fissures are within the Democratic Party 8 months before primary voting begins. Thursday's debate, like the one a night earlier, gave millions of Americans their first peek inside the Democrats' unruly 2020 season. The showdown featured four of the five strongest candidates, according to early polls at least. Those are Biden, Sanders, Pete Buttigieg of Indiana, and Harris, Kamala Harris. Now, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who debated on Wednesday night, is the fifth. There are so many candidates lining up to take on Trump that they do not fit. They not all fit in one debate stage, or even two. 20 Democrats debated on national television this week in two waves of 10, while a handful more were left out altogether. The level of diversity on display was unprecedented for a major political party in the United States. The field features six women, two African Americans, one Asian American, and two men under 40, one of them openly gay. Yet in the early days of the campaign, two white septuagenarians are leading the polls, Biden and Vermont Senator Sanders. Thursday's slate of candidates and the debate itself highlighted and the unprecedented diversity of the Democratic Party's 2020 class. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, a 37-year-old gay former military officer, is four decades younger than Sanders and has been framing his candidacy as a call for generational change in his party. Harris is the only African-American woman to qualify for the presidential debate stage. Any of the three women featured Thursday night would be the first ever elected president. Now, Buttigieg faced tough questions about a racially charged recent police shooting in a city in which a white officer shot and killed a black man, Eric Logan. Buttigieg said an investigation was underway, and he acknowledged the underlying racial tension in the city and others. "It's a mess," he said plainly, "and we're hurting." Interestingly enough, Buttigieg also pointed out that the officer that killed the black man claimed that the man held a gun, and that's why he was shot. But the camera that the officer was supposed to be carrying, he didn't have. So it becomes questionable. And Buttigieg said he can't comment at that particular time because it has to go to court, and that's where it's being fought. Now, one of the lesser-known candidates on stage is California Representative Eric Swalwell, called on Buttigieg to fire his police chief, even though the investigation was only beginning. Swalwell also took a swipe at Biden's advanced age. Either Biden or Sanders would be the oldest president ever elected. Joe Biden was right when he said it was time to pass the torch to a new generation of Americans 32 years ago, Swalwell jabbed. And Biden responded, I'm still holding on to that torch. Well, the party's broader fight over ideology played a backseat at times to the racial and generational divisions. But calls to embrace dramatic change on immigration, health care, and the environment were not forgotten. Sanders slapped at his party's centrist candidates, vowing to fight for real change, quote unquote. Biden downplayed his establishment leanings. For example, the former vice president, along with the other candidates on stage, raised his hand to say the health care plan would provide coverage for immigrants in the country illegally. Former California, or rather Colorado, Governor John Hickenlooper predicted that an aggressive lurch to the left on key policies would ultimately hurt Democrats' quest to defeat Trump. If we don't clearly define we are not socialists, the Republicans are going to come at us every way they can and call us socialists, he warned. Others on the stage Thursday night included Senators Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Michael Bennett of Colorado, New York businessman Andrew Yang, and author and social activist Mariana Williamson. The showdown played out in Florida, a general election battleground that could well determine whether Trump wins a second term next year. Biden sought to sidestep the intra-party divisions altogether, training his venom on Trump. Donald Trump thinks Wall Street built America. Ordinary middle-class Americans built America, said the former vice president. He added, Donald Trump has put us in a horrible situation. We do have enormous income inequality, end quote. Now, Biden's strategy is designed to highlight his status as the front runner and, as such, the Democrat best positioned to take down the president at the ballot box among any policy disagreement. Democratic voters report that nothing matters more than finding a candidate who can beat Trump. Their first round of debates is finished, but the real struggle is just beginning for most of the candidates. All will work aggressively to leverage their debate performance and the related media attention to their advantage in the coming days. There is a real sense of urgency for more than a dozen candidates who fear they may not reach donor and polling thresholds to qualify for subsequent debates. Should they fail to qualify, and many will fail, this week's debates may have marked the high point for their personal presidential ambitions. My God, stuff that goes on, huh? Whew, boy, tragic. Anyway, let's look at some other things that are happening in our world. Evidently, it's 50 years on, and the Stonewall veteran recalls a milestone for LGBT rights. Well, Martin Boyce was 21 years old in June of 1969. The night the riots began, he was in Greenwich Village. He heard cries coming from the Stonewall Inn. The police had come to raid the bar frequented by the gay and trans community. I came along a paddy wagon here, Boyce recalls. At the end of the paddy wagon, I noticed a brutal cop pushing a drag queen into the paddy wagon, but she was resisting and she was able to kick him in the shoulder. A very good shot. He went flying and he went back at her like a bull. He dragged her into the truck and you heard flesh, bone against thin metal and moans, and we started slowly walking towards him stealthily. I could see the hairs on his neck rise. We just kept looking at him and focused on him, but he saw something in our eyes, something in our faces. He was unnerved, unmanned, and he broke and ran for the bar door. In 1969, gay sex was illegal, and the American Psychiatric Association considered homosexuality a mental illness. If you were a homosexual and announced at a bar that you wanted a drink, you could not be served a drink. You could be arrested for solicitation for entrapment, said Ken Lustbader, co-founder of the New York City LGBT Historic Sites Project. That night marked a turning point. It sparked 6 days of protest. The LGBT community united and fought back against oppression. In 2016, Barack Obama declared the site of the uprising a national monument on a par with the Grand Canyon and the Statue of Liberty, but the struggle is not yet over. Donald Trump and this administration is a threat to LGBT rights, said Lust Bader. It's a threat to anyone who's different, and it's a threat that should not be taken lightly, end quote. On Sunday, New Yorkers will fly the rainbow flag, as they march for gay pride. Boyce will be there, head held high, proud of the part he played in the history of the gay rights movement. So that's something to look forward to. For a lot of people, certainly the parade is a hoot, to say the least. Now let's just see what else. Okay, I want to go over to some other stuff. 1 second. This is interesting to talk about molestation and stuff. A Norwegian man has been sentenced to 16 years for abusing hundreds of boys. A Norwegian man was sentenced to 16 years in prison today for the sexual abuse, including rape, of several hundred underage boys in what was described as the largest such case in the country's history. For several years now, the 27-year-old posed as a young girl online, mainly calling herself Sandra, and using deception and threats to obtain sexual videos from some 460 boys, many under the age of 16. However, the charges against him, which included sexual abuse and rape, only concerned 270 of the victims. The man, who was also a football referee, impersonated a young girl and promised sweets, smartphones, naked photos, or sexual favors to lure his victims to send him videos, and in a few cases to meet him, and then demanded more by threatening to publish the videos. The man admitted to some of the charges against him when he appeared before the Nedre Romerike District Court in the country's southeast. The sentence is among the tougher handed out for sexual abuse in the Scandinavian country, in line with the prosecutor's claim that it was, quote, the largest case of sexual abuse in Norway, end quote. The man's lawyers simply pleaded for the most lenient sentence possible. The perpetrator was first arrested back in June of 2016, but he was subsequently released, allowing him to continue his actions until his second arrest in October of that year. He was also ordered to pay 18.6 million Norwegian krona, that's $2.2 million, in compensation for his victims. My God. You know, amazing. Just amazing. Okay, so let's carry on and look at some other things that are coming about. Evidently, France is no underdog in the quarterfinal match against Team USA. Well, current world champions Team USA face home team Les Bleus at Parc des Princes in Paris on Friday. That's today. In a heat wave, a women's football golf World Cup quarterfinal match as anticipated as any final. This could be the sports story of the summer. It is this sport, world sports, World Cup's hot ticket, if not the most expensive. On Friday, online ticket site StubHub was selling entire entries to tonight's match for 10,000 euros. Meanwhile, tickets for Saturday's quarterfinals match between Germany and Sweden on FIFA's official site were going for 15 euros. 15 euros as opposed to 10,000 euros. My God, the U.S. may be arriving with the title, but that does not mean they will leave with it. The French are anything but the underdogs in this game. The Americans have played the French 23 times, with France winning just 3 of those meetings. But the last 3 matches have tilted toward France with 2 wins and a draw. And the French have actually beaten the Americans already this year 3-1 in a January friendly. They've got a great trophy cabinet, and we still have everything to prove, French captain Amandine Henry said. And the host team also boasts a home advantage and a rowdy French crowd, all primed to cheer on Les Bleus, the Blues. Currently ranked number 4 in the world, Les Bleus finished at the top of their group before overcoming a determined challenge from Brazil on June 23rd to reach the quarterfinals. The French national team has seen its profile rise considerably in recent years, coinciding with the growth of its domestic professional league. The core of the team is made up of Lyon's all-conquering side, Europe's best women's team, and four-time Champions League winners. Now, Henri is one of the world's best defensive midfielders. Striker Eugénie Lestomère is closing in on France's all-time scoring record, and Wendy Renard, a 1.87 meters, that's almost like a six-footer. So she's got to be more like 5'8". The tallest player in the tournament is a central defender who has scored three times in this tournament. Now, France is seeking to become the first nation to simultaneously hold the men's and women's World Cup trophies after their men's team won in Russia last year. Yet the U.S. is not invincible, so they claim. The U.S., on the other hand, are the returning title holders. They already have three World Cup trophies in their cabinet, more than any other country. However, they do not appear to be entirely invincible. So the U.S. may have started this campaign with a decisive 13-0 victory over Thailand. But the team has been less than convincing in recent matches, their spirits apparently flagging. Top scorer Alexandra Morgan, has been surprisingly scoreless since her five-goal opening game. And they were in serious trouble in their last match, a tightly won 2-1 victory over Spain after disputed penalties. And from where we were 4 years ago and where France was 4 years ago, I think both of us are much stronger teams. I think just the women's game in general has grown tremendously, said U.S. star and co-captain Megan Rapinoe. Quote, I guess the task for each team is to be the team that is growing as fast as the game is, keeping up on that, and even being the one that is pushing the game forward. Rapinoe has herself helped promote the anticipation of this game. She engaged in something of a spat with none other than the U.S. president himself this week when she said she did not plan to visit the White House if invited. And then, to add fuel to the fire, there is the weather. France is in the middle of a record-breaking heat wave. The forecast called for 30 degrees centigrade in Paris as the start of the match. Weary legs will feel even heavier. Kickoff at the Parc des Princes Stadium in Paris at 9 p.m. local time. So we're looking at temperatures here, 30 degrees Celsius. It's got to be closer to like 90. So we'll see exactly what goes on there. It's about the 90s, so very, 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 very grueling time to be playing. But I guess it's a balancing act, and both countries will suffer, and that is for sure. Let me see what else is going on that might be of interest. I want to move on to what's happening in the Middle East. It's almost 11 o'clock now. One second. Actually, not much has gone on there because for whatever reasons. So let's just see what else is happening. Maybe we'll just check to see what's happening on other places. And I don't know if you heard about this. This actually came out yesterday, but very important to know. I'm very, very worried. Personally, I'm very worried about Boeing. I'm worried that they're going to lose their preeminent role, and they have killed themselves because of greed. So this is the story. Regulators identify a new problem with the Boeing 737 MAX. So the Federal Aviation Administration has identified a potential new problem with Boeing 737 MAX planes grounded since March after two deadly crashes. Also, a group of Google employees have written to the organizers of San Francisco's Pride Parade to ask them to exclude the company from the event. And and so on, because they're saying that Google's not doing enough to act on behalf of the LGBT community. So these are the two issues that are being covered. Listen to this report. One second. One second. Okay, here we go. One second. Sorry, a moment. Oh, my goodness. We're almost there, but it looks like it's a little bit of a slow take for some reason. All right, we're just going to start in a moment, see what happens. For some crazy reason, it's not taking, I don't know why. Let me just see if I could resuscitate it. Let me start again. Bear with me a moment. One moment. Okay, looks like it's now just hit. It's going to take now. I think. We'll see you in a moment.
Yeah. Now to take a look at the latest business news, and we're going to start with yet more trouble for Boeing over its 737 MAX aircraft. Our business editor, Stephen Carl, is with us with all the details. Stephen.
Eve, a new software problem has been found in the 737 MAX that could delay its return to service. The aircraft was grounded back in March following two deadly crashes. Now, test pilots for the Federal Aviation Administration discovered the potential problem last week, the exact details of which haven't been officially disclosed. The regulator has told Boeing to correct the problem before a formal test flight, which could allow the plane to be cleared for use with passengers again. Owen Barnell has the details.
Another major setback for Boeing. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has identified a new problem with the 737 MAX. Boeing must correct the issue before it undergoes fresh tests by the FAA, meaning there's no quick way back for the troubled model. Bad news for the American jetmaker, who had hoped to have the 737 MAX up in the skies for the busy summer season.
The Federal Aviation Administration is following a thorough process, not a prescribed timeline, for returning the Boeing 737 MAX to passenger service. The FAA will lift the aircraft's prohibition order when we deem it safe to do so.
Boeing's global fleet of 400 737 MAX jets has been grounded since March, following crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia that left 346 dead. The MCAS anti-SOL software was involved in both of the deadly 737 MAX crashes. Boeing only mentioned its existence after the Lion Air crash in Indonesia, took even longer to disclose the fact that an alert system linked to MCAS did not work. It's not clear what new problem FAA test pilots have identified, but as delays mount, carriers are being forced to make alternative plans. United Airlines were the latest on Wednesday to pull the MAX from its schedules until September 3rd. Boeing disclosed an initial financial hit of $1 billion earlier this year, and with thousands more flights now affected, the costs could remain sky high.
Well, the business world will be watching the G20 closely in the coming days to see if there'll be any progress between the US and China in resolving their trade dispute. As we were hearing from our correspondent there a short time ago, representatives in Washington and Beijing spoke by phone earlier this week. In an interview on Wednesday, President Trump said that China wants to make a deal because, quote, their economy was going down the tubes. Now, while it's unlikely that a full agreement will be announced in Japan, experts say that the signals from Saturday's Trump-Xi meeting could be important.
I think if Xi Jinping and President Trump have some negotiations between the two, that will have a very positive impact to the world economy, because currently the world economy was watching just fighting between the two countries. So I think their meeting here will mitigate those fears, and then the market can be regained again at a stable manner.
Now, President Trump has also been lashing out at other trading partners in the run-up to the G20. He describes Vietnam as the single worst abuser on trade, and in this tweet, lashed out at what he called unacceptable tariffs from India on American goods. Now, India imposed tariffs on around 20 items from the US earlier this month. That was in retaliation for American levies on steel and aluminium imports. New Delhi had actually delayed its tariffs by more than a year in the hope of reaching a bilateral agreement with the US. Trade's been a big issue for the markets as well. Things looking a bit optimistic in the run-up to that big meeting this weekend. European share markets opening in the green ever so slightly, being led by mining companies. Of course, that's always important, a barometer for business in China. In Paris, shares in the carmaker Renault are up. That's after President Macron said there was no need for the French government to reduce its stake in the carmaker. In Asia earlier, we had gains across the board. Trade, of course, the big issue there as well. The Nikkei in Tokyo and the Hang Seng in Hong Kong both up over 1%. Now, the organisers of the San Francisco Pride Parade say they won't exclude Google from the event, despite calls from some of the company's own employees to do so. Around 100 Google staff wrote to the parade's organisers asking them to decline the internet giant's sponsorship and ban it from taking part. Their call was over what the workers say is Google's failure to act on behalf of LGBTQ communities when it comes to harassment, discrimination and hate speech on YouTube and other Google platforms. In response, SF Pride says the company has historically been an ally, but it has acknowledged that it needs to do more to promote respectful discussion. Eve.
Thanks a lot, Stephen, for that. Stephen Carl there with our business update.
Okay, so I think we've covered that. Let me just quickly look. I don't think there's much more news and information that I have to share with you. I think we're really okay. We've covered all the points. So let me just quickly look to see if anything's happened, particularly in Europe. And I'm sure you've heard about the Genoa Bridge that collapsed. Well, they blew it all up so that it's no longer there. So that's the end of that. Wildfires are raging in Spain's Catalonia region, which we spoke about. Seems that Germany has arrested a Bosnian suspect linked to the 2015 Paris attacks, which is amazing. And what else? I think that's it. So, we're going to be able to talk to you back on Monday. We'll have a lot to talk about. And there's a show, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called In the Mix, I-N for in, and then the, T-H-E, and then the word mix, M-I-X-X, In the Mix. You could look that up. It's on the internet. And it's a live streaming show, and they invited me to attend their evening program on Sunday. So Sunday from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock at night, inthemix.com, and you'll see a photo of me. And hopefully I'll say something of relevance. It's a political show, and I don't know who else is invited, but they asked me to come, and so I was flattered. I was there last week, and we were talking about the election for Mount Vernon. So that was very, very compelling and very exciting. So I enjoyed that immensely. And then I did notice one other thing, you know, because here we were live streaming, and I usually don't get a shot of myself. So here I had the earpiece on, and I noticed that it looked like the top of my head is totally bald. Just never realized it because I guess I didn't see it from that view. So evidently I'm just thinning up there, and so I'm follically challenged, and hopefully I don't have any other challenges in life, but that's one that I've accepted. So that's the story. Anyway. So have a great weekend. All the best. It's going to be hot, so be careful, whatever you do. And then check, especially with older people, you never know. Sometimes they forget to drink and they're not well hydrated. So maybe that's something to think about. And also just maybe carry a bottle of water with you wherever you go. So that's important. Well, thanks again. We'll speak to you on Monday. Enjoy the weekend. Bye.